Hannah.
Good evening.
Good evening.
We're just waiting, and since I know you have a question.
Okay.
Seems to be quiet, huh?
It does. I got to thinking about it, and I'm wondering if it isn't a labeling of the Portofino sun, if that's where that thinking comes from.
Say that again. I didn't follow you.
Well, you know how with the Portofino, they have mother, they have father, they have son. And I got to thinking that maybe that was where the labeling sun would be connected.
Oh yeah, no, that's clearly part of what the church, the language that they took out of Judaism.
Okay.
Well.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Do you have any questions tonight?
I do have one. When does a soul become a living being? When the soul is in the mother's womb.
Are you asking with respect to abortions or just generally in a different way?
Yes, and abortion and Jewish law, I guess.
I'm not an expert in this area, but the information that I've received from my teachers is the 40th day.
Mm-hmm.
If a husband and wife are intimate on the 40th day, they're told not to be intimate on that day because that might terminate the pregnancy. It might kill the child, God forbid. And it's an indication that after the 40th day is when the soul is settled into the body. Until that, those first 39-40 days, the soul moves in and out of the body, so to speak. As the body is developing, only parts of the soul can fit within the body. And so different parts of the soul kind of rotate into the body. It's really not a good language, good word to describe it, but there really isn't much else. So the idea is that during those first 40 days, the soul can move in and move out of the body, but settled into the body, the soul, meaning that the baby has become a person, a living being, would be after the 40th day.
And you say this is upon knowing that that she's pregnant. From that point on, you count 40 days?
No, from conception, not from the knowledge of when she's pregnant.
Okay.
Of course, in today's world, I believe what the pregnancy tests can tell you within 4 or 5 days of conception.
Right.
Whereas in earlier times, it was roughly about 2 weeks before you knew it.
Okay. Wow. Okay.
What also I was told by my teachers is that when it comes to an abortion, which was the techniques were known in temple times, primarily with herbs and other drug type approaches, that it was really, and even today, it's not recommended unless you go to a Kabbalist. And they were very specific. You have to go to someone who is on the level of a Kabbalist so that they can peer into the souls and the tikkun of the two souls to relate the priorities between the mother and the child with respect to having an abortion or not. And in my opinion, there aren't people of that caliber. The decision to have an abortion is really not an easy one today, as if it was ever easy, because obviously it isn't and wasn't.
So, and you said the Kabbalist would be the one to go to in biblical times, right?
The members of the Sanhedrin.
And why would they? I mean, back in temple times, it was a blessing to carry a child. So
it still is.
So their reasoning for wanting abortion is why in temple time? Because I thought that was very sacred. And it is always sacred that you carry a child, but was that because they were raped, or?
It could be because of rape. It could be because of health issues. It could be because of many different issues. Same, they're similar issues to why women, have a desire or. Have the conflict over keeping a baby or having an abortion today. Only today you have ways of birth control that weren't available in those days. And today you have other, approaches with respect to, terminating a pregnancy.
So how does, what does the Zohar say about terminating a pregnancy?
That's what I was saying. It's not recommended unless to a Kabbalist and ask them to peer into your soul and the soul of the fetus, the potential soul of the fetus, and determine what is right for the tikkun of both.
Okay. With that said, being in the reincarnation classes, a soul gets reincarnated in the nefesh, okay? Does that,
yes.
And this is probably a silly question, but at that point, the soul entering to a nefesh, do they know that this mother may not carry this the soul to full term?
Sure. Everything is known at the spiritual level.
So I wonder why they would enter
they would enter, because it's their tikkun. They need to have they need to be in the physical form for so many number of days as part of their tikkun.
Okay. So it may not just be a short period of time, and even knowing that the mother will terminate the pregnancy, that the time that they need will be justifiable to them, I guess. I don't know if that's the correct word. But that's all they would need. So they would enter that body just for that length of time.
Correct.
Okay.
And the same thing applies to a child who has a terminal illness. They came into that body for a short period of time. There's a wonderful story of, I believe it was the Baal Shem Tov, but it may have been the Magid de Mezrich, where this couple went to the Baal Shem Tov, I'm going to say, and after many years of not having a child, wanting a child, and there's a halakha that if you're in the land of Israel after 10 years of marriage without any children, that it's appropriate to divorce. And they were approaching that 10-year limit, and even though it was outside of the land of Israel, there are some people who don't understand that halakha, and there were people making decisions based on what they had been told, that it's that if you have 10 years of marriage without children, that it's recommended to divorce. So this couple went to the Baal Shem Tov and was asked for a blessing to have a child. And the Baal Shem Tov said he wanted to give them a blessing for healing. And they said, no, we want the child. So the Baal Shem Tov blessed them with a child, and next year they had the child. And then about the time of weaning, which is about 3 years old, the child died. And they came back to the Baal Shem Tov and said, how could you bless us with a sickly child like this? And the Baal Shem Tov said, let me tell you the story. And he proceeded to relate to what the tikkun of their son who had died actually was. And the way the story goes, if my memory serves me, the child had been stolen by the non-Jewish couple or non-Jewish family, and was raised his first 3 years in that environment of not having a Jewish home. And so his tikkun was to come back and experience life for those 3 years. And then there was no need for it, because he had become a tzaddik in the previous incarnation, but he needed to complete this with the 3 years in a Jewish home. And their desire for a child was so great that they drew this child, who was a very righteous soul. And you have a similar story when you talk about the woman who built the room for Elisha, and he blessed her with a child, and the child died, and he was resurrected by Elisha. And that child ended up becoming the the prophet Habakkuk, which has the meaning of two of something. I don't remember the exact meaning of Habakkuk, but it relates to the fact that he had two lives, that he had been resurrected. So everything is known at the spiritual level. That doesn't mean that the souls are going to perceive the world with the same culture that we perceive the world. You know, just as you said, why would a soul come into a body knowing it was going to die? But the same question could be asked, why would a soul ever come into a body, because everybody has died up till now, except for seven people.
That's so true. That's so true.
So, I mean, it's your perspective. To you, a short life is, you know, you think is not worth it, but it completes the tikkun for many of these children.
Would that also apply to a child that's born stillborn?
Yes. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, what we see as America is that they say it's not, in the abortion world or clinics, they state that it's not a child, it's just living tissue, you know, even almost at the time of birth. Hello? There?
Okay. I understand.
And are they saying it's not a living being until it takes its first breath outside the mother's womb? And I was always puzzled, I'm quite disturbed about that, actually. So
yeah,
thank you for that explanation.
You're welcome, but I would stress also that you're upset over that issue. Comes from the culture that you were raised in and the culture that we all live in. Yes, there are people saying, as you said, that the child is not a, the fetus is not a child. It's not a life until it takes a breath. But again, the spiritual world evaluates things very differently than we do in the physical world. And we need to recognize what we have absorbed from our culture, you know, and to let go of those things that limit our spiritual growth. So when someone says something like that it's not a living being until it takes a breath, you can just relate to them that if you're looking at the idea of reincarnation, it becomes a living being when the soul is settled into the body. And that might cause them to think differently than they do. But we always have to remember, even though we don't agree, or I may not agree with that statement, doesn't mean the statement is wrong from their point of view. Their point of view is strictly a physical perception. Now, we know that that's not a valid total approach, but that doesn't mean there's a reason why the culture is there and why the culture has that. We don't understand that yet. We've never discussed, you know, why was Roe v. Wade, why was that decree, that judgment, you know, created by the Supreme Court? We haven't asked that question. I know I haven't asked that question. Why was it done, and what is the spiritual meaning for that? Of course
there's an answer. I mean, do we know?
It, just, unless I've asked the question before and contemplated it, the answer is hasn't been revealed to me, and so, and that's true today. I don't have the reason why Roe v. Wade was a judgment of the court, but it clearly is, it has established a significant amount of tikkunim for people since that period of time where they made decisions about abortions, where they made decisions about, you know, why was the pill. Why was the pill developed? It's a technology that has given freedom of sexual expression to women in a greater way. There's people who say that because of the pill, a woman has no less fear of pregnancy, less fear of death in pregnancy, and can feel a greater freedom to have an orgasm. I've heard that expressed. You know, what's the reason why the pill was developed? We don't really know all. There is always an answer, but it doesn't mean that that answer has been revealed to individuals or to the culture at all, as a whole. Are there any other questions?
I have one more. No one else has a question at this point.
That's fine. There is another question, but it we're going to do that at the end anyway.
Okay. Why does it take 40 days, so in the body? Or is this kind of coming into the body and leaving the body in that period of time? Is there a reason for that?
Of course there's a reason. Whether it's been revealed to us or not, there's always a reason. The answer to your question, on one level, the answer would be because the 40 days in this world is equivalent to an hour in Shemaya. Of course, that's a metaphor because there may not, you know, time has a totally different perception and understanding in heaven than it does on earth. As we know that the creation took 6 days with resting on the seventh, but that was actually 13.5 billion years, according to modern science and according to the calculations that have been made by the various sages over the centuries, explaining what is the length of the creation, when was the Big Bang, and how long ago was that, and all of that purpose. I don't want to go into that. It'll take it. But on another level, and again, I'm not an expert in this area, but I would think that the body, up until the 40th day, the body of the fetus may not have the full capability of a human being. We know that it can't live outside the mother's womb, but prior to the 40th day, it may be that the brain may not be fully developed or sufficiently developed. The lungs may not be sufficiently developed. All of the parts of the body may not have reached their full, their initial growth that would be considered whole. Something along those lines would be the answer that we would get from science once they really delve into that. I don't know if you're aware of it, but there's this whole process that the fetus relives the evolutionary process. It goes from one cell to a multicelled organism, and then from that point it separates into various organs and different types of cell, into different organs and so forth. It needs to be of a sufficient size, a sufficient number of cells. So all of that, as I said, I'm not an expert in the physiology, but I'm sure that also flows into the question as to why 40 days. You could ask the same question, why was it 40 years of wandering in the desert? Why was the flood 40 days and nights? It's all related to what is that, what is the relationship between 40 days on earth and the essence of that period in Shemayim, in heaven.
Some fetuses are not complete when they are brought into the world. They are lacking organs. They'll survive with those disabilities, and so some are.
That's all related to tikkun.
Okay.
So if somebody is born without arms, there was something in their previous life that said this soul needs to live in this world with this limitation as part of its tikkun. That doesn't mean that we shouldn't do everything possible to make that life full and complete and as best as possible.
Mm-hmm. Well, if the soul is so linked to the blood, I would think that it might be a link there as to when the blood begins to develop in the fetus. But that's just intellectual.
Yeah.
Do you remember when thalidomide was being issued to all these women and they consequently had children born without arms and legs?
Yes.
Is that something would be a tikkun, or was that something else?
No, it was a tikkun. It was a tikkun for the parents. It was a tikkun for the doctor. It was a tikkun for the medical world. It was a tikkun for the children. All of it was very everything is interrelated. But everything relates to tikkun. Are there any other questions? Go ahead.
Well, this is on a different subject, so should I wait until next week to discuss this one?
No, we have time. Go ahead.
Okay. Why does a male soul take on, and I think I kind of mentioned this the other night, When a male soul is born, they don't feel like they're a male. They feel more like they're a female. So when a soul comes down, it has two parts, male and female, and it splits. I think that's correct. So does that split, I know what Shem does is perfect, everything he does. But why does a male feel more drawn to the female side than the male that he was born, the male body?
Are you asking why there are people who have male sex organs but feel that they're really women?
Yes, thank you for clarifying that. Yes, clarifying that.
Or vice versa of a soul comes into a body that is female, and it feels that it's male. The transgender
designation.
Or is now that I recently read, it's no longer he or she, it's now Z. But the answer to your question is it's tikkun.
Right.
And that there in the Talmud, there are seven Hebrew words that describes sex. It doesn't just say male or female, or even male, female, and hermaphrodite. If there are four other designations for the sex of a person. And the Talmud spends a great deal of time discussing what aspects of holiness relate to the different levels of sex. So this is all part of tikkun. And again, you know, in earlier generations, they didn't have the opportunity to become, you know, to transform themselves surgically. Whereas in this generation, for whatever the tikkun aspect is, they do. But it's all always related to tikkun.
So the way I see this, and I'm very simple-minded, but the way I see that is that technology and advancement in science, medical field, communications in our world now has enabled the souls to complete their tikkun because of the advancement in the world. That's kind of what I'm thinking. And like, again, I'm simple-minded when it comes to this type of question.
Malka, you're not simple-minded. It's a very logical, rational approach. But that doesn't mean that's how the spiritual world would look at it. I'll give you a potential alternative. The soul has this tikkun. It's come into this culture and this scientific development and this technology that makes it available, and that transition allows its tikkun to be less harsh. Whereas if it was in an earlier generation, the tikkun would be more difficult. But it's really, what is the tikkun of the soul? What is needed for the soul? So it's not a question of saying, yes, the technology is there for the purposes of completing the tikkun. It just means that the tikkun has greater amount of mercy. It has been sweetened, as we talk about in for the judgment of Rosh Hashanah, to sweeten the judgment.
And I have to say this, and I'm not proud that I think this way sometimes, but when you see certain things, you think evil incarnation, and that's probably the wrong way to think. You know, when you see people acting out homosexual, transgender, I mean the whole thing, you know, you sit and you wonder, is this evil incarnation? Did they not try striking by binding, I think you said? And this is kind of my thought pattern, and I'm trying to not think that way, you know, more compassion because I don't know what they're going through, so I'm trying to learn to be more compassion and not think that way.
I'm going to give you a different understanding. Let's say someone had been born into temple times, meaning the Roman Empire was in control, and in the Roman Empire, perhaps the values were different, but that soul had a homosexual experience. Now, it wasn't a good idea for the soul to do that, so it was considered a mistake spiritually. And so the next incarnation, they're brought to a situation where they have an opportunity again for a homosexual experience. And this time, again, they choose to do it. And so it's considered a mistake in the spiritual frame. Now, we understand that they will always be given an opportunity to change that decision process, either through teshuvah or their next lifetime. And the idea is, each time that happens, each time you're given another opportunity, it's a little bit more difficult. So now we're in our modern day, and they've had 10 or 15 or 20 or 3 lifetimes where they've been given opportunities to have homosexual experiences that they should not choose to do. And they've done it each time. And so now we're in a situation where the society is saying it's okay to be homosexual. It's okay to love who you want to love. It's much harder to say no if your culture is saying it's okay than if you are in a culture that frowns on it and you have to hide it. It's much harder to say no in this culture than in earlier cultures. So when you say you don't want to have the value that you're expressing, the real issue is you have not yet realized what you have absorbed from your culture, from our culture, because we've all absorbed it. Nobody thinks twice about driving down the road and seeing a brassiere ad. But do you think there are children and teenagers who are masturbating because they've seen that ad? The answer is yes. Now, is it wrong to masturbate? It's a lot harder to say no to masturbation in this society when the psychologists are telling you it's healthy. Put things in the context of tikkun. You're given an opportunity to do the right action, whatever that would be. And you did a wrong action. So they're going to give you another opportunity. But that next opportunity is going to be a little bit more difficult. The next lifetime, the same opportunity is going to be there, but it's going to be a little bit more difficult. Until ultimately, we've reached a point in this society, which, as we're getting closer to the 6,000th year, it's a lot more difficult to not masturbate in this society than it was in biblical society. That's just one example. But let's move on, because we do have a question which I think is going to be interesting to people. Kana, do you want to ask it?
Well, I didn't quite know how to word it. And I maybe should have saved it for later on, because it was just a statement I remember. I did say a Kabbalah teacher considers the man from Nazareth a Kabbalist, and really this teacher doesn't consider himself a Kabbalist. He considers himself a student of Kabbalah. And I ask that you give your view, but really I'm not so much sure that I should ask for your view as to, can you give some explanation as to why this person would think that?
Well, without knowing the person per se, it's hard to know what their teacher's teaching is. But if you're talking about the Kabbalah Center, the question is really related to the man from Nazareth as to ultimately the root of the question is, why is there a Christian religion? And the Kabbalah Center has said that I believe there was a 16th century Kabbalist who wrote that the man from Nazareth was the Messiah. Now, this is coming out of a Jewish worldview. It was a Christian worldview, but that if you go back to the time of the New Testament and before the New Testament, the life of the man from Nazareth, there are two specific views that are generally held within the children of Israel and within the Kabbalah. The two specific views are, in the Talmud, there's a section that is usually not publicized over the centuries because of the potential danger of the Christian world attacking the Jewish people and world based on this information. But what the section in the Talmud says is that the man from Nazareth was studying with one of the members of the Sanhedrin. And in that time, in the biblical times, the temple times, the Sanhedrin, each of the 70 members of the Sanhedrin were teaching students how to be members of the Sanhedrin. They were teaching them how to be prophets. They were teaching them different skills, some of which you're being taught today by me or others on how to do unifications, how to connect to Hashem so that you can hear a prophecy. Not that we have capability of prophecy today, but the techniques are known. And so this section of the Talmud says that the man from Nazareth was training to be a member of the Sanhedrin, which means he was training to be a Kabbalist. And his teacher, one of the members of the Sanhedrin, saw something within him and decided that he could no longer teach him. There was some aspect of ego that had not yet been cleansed. And the teacher said, I can no longer continue your training. This is the areas that you need to work on. And come back when you're ready. The man from Nazareth's reaction to this was anger, was upset, and he justified his actions by saying, it's time for the Mashiach. And there was very much a sense in biblical time that the temple, the Mashiach would come in about 450, 475 years after the return from Babylonia. And so he justified his actions of walking on water, on healing the sick, all of these different miracles that are written about in the New Testament. But always remember, the New Testament was written 70 years after the event. So those 70 years could and probably did distort what was written down. But even so, the Talmud is saying that the man from Nazareth, his reaction was to say, it's time for the Messiah, it's time for the resurrection, it's time for this chaos to end. We have the tools, and so let's teach it to everybody. There's no reason to keep this concealed from the populace anymore. And so that's what he went out and started to teach. Now, a different understanding, but consistent with what I just said, is that we read the books or the writings about the deaths of the 10 martyrs that the Romans killed. We read that on Tisha B'Av, and sometimes on some people do it on Yom Kippur. But there are 11, there's 12 tribes, there's 11 righteous people who should have died. Because Benjamin, even though he didn't participate in the sale of Joseph, which is the reason for the death of those 10 martyrs, because they were reincarnation of the 10 brothers who sold Joseph. The 11th brother was still a member of the generation, and so had some aspect of tikkun for the sale. And because of that, who was the 11th reincarnation? Who was the 11th son? Who was Benjamin's reincarnation? And the teaching in that aspect, and that's what the 16th century sage wrote down, is the man from Nazareth was the reincarnation, the 11th of the sons, Benjamin. And his role was to learn this material and then to send it out as a proselytizing technique to the pagan nations to bring the light of Hashem into the world and be the cause of the one God being taught to the pagan nations. Now, with that understanding, which is what the Kabbalah Center perceives and what they teach today, they weren't teaching it when I studied there, but what they teach today is that the man from Nazareth was this 11th martyr, and so he died in the method of crucifixion, so that he would promote sending Paul, one of his disciples, out to the pagan nations to bring the light of God into the pagan nations. And by virtue of numbers, as we look around in our world today, he has been very successful. Now, it comes with certain corruptions. And we have to realize that there are multiple levels of the teachings in Christianity, so that there are certain groups of Christians who perceive that the man from Nazareth is the Son, S-O-N, the Son of God. But in our Jewish prophecies, we know that every one of us is capable of becoming a son to God. And so it's all part of this confusion of the history and the corruption and the church having its power and wanting, having its own agenda. But even in those, in many Christian groups, they don't think that the man from Nazareth was a son of God or a god. They don't see it the same way that the Catholic Church does. And this is all coming from different levels of paganism, different levels of idol worship, different levels of these mistakes. But when you read a student of Kabbalah teaching that the man from Nazareth was a Kabbalist, on one hand you're being told that he wasn't ready to be a man, a Kabbalist, but he learned certain tools which he then took out into the common man to teach. Before its time is one thought, or for the purpose of bringing the light of God to the pagan nations is another thought. Now, I don't really wish to express my own personal opinion because it's not my path. My path is to teach Kabbalah.
Okay, thank you.
I always try and give these, and I don't know if you remember it, but I've spoken this to groups and in recordings. I've expressed this many times in answer to the what people asking in a basic class, what does Kabbalah think of the man from Nazareth? So I have expressed this before. There's a whole video out of the Kabbalah Center where the the idea of the Catholic Church, the word Golgotha, which you see on the Tikkun HaNefesh chart, Golgotha has a great different, you know, tremendous meaning within the Catholic Church. What is the Golgotha? You know, it's the man, the 16th century sage, who was Italian, I believe, was his background. He was supposed to be, if the generation was ready, he would have been the Mashiach ben Yosef, according to his own writings. So you always have to take this with a grain of salt. But the man from, you know, the teaching is, and what the Kabbalah Center presents, is that this is all part of the plan of creation, of bringing the light of God into the pagan world so that they would come to understand one God. And then it will all be ultimately through the Mashiach or through the personal choices, we will end up in a frame of unity where we appreciate the diversity. So I hope I've not confused you, and that I've explained both approaches as to how we can understand the man from Nazareth and the rise and the strength of the Christian religion, and also the Muslim religion, which has its own basis we didn't discuss, but it's all part of the same system.
Okay,
so either he was not ready to be trained, and he was partially trained and went off on his own, or this was his tikkun, and this is what was necessary in order to bring the knowledge of God to the pagan nations.
Well, it made me think of how Hashem had Balaam as a prophet for the nations. when he had Moses as one for, you know, for the Hebrews. So it makes sense that he would have a man that would bring righteousness to the nations, even, you know, even though they don't see Hashem as being the ultimate sovereign. In other words, it's kind of like mercy, because they still do bring righteousness, it, you know, in that particular religion.
Are there any other questions?
You stated that he was either a martyr or he was a reincarnated soul of Benjamin and or a prophet. Or, is that correct?
No.
No, okay.
What I said was one teaching is that he was a reincarnated soul of Benjamin.
Okay.
And as such, in that generation, he needed to be the 11th martyr. So
okay.
his death by the Romans, by the Jews, I don't want to get into that argument. His death was part of the 10 martyrs and now the 11 martyrs. And
so that's
one approach. The other approach is that he was being trained to be a prophet, which was, there's one estimate that there were 3 million people in the schools of prophets during temple times.
Okay.
So it was very much part of who the society and the culture was doing. They were training people, they were teaching people how to know Kabbalah, how to have a connection, a meditative, a Kabbalah, a Hitbodedut connection to Hashem. And he may have been taught that completely, in which case the 11th martyr makes sense. Or he may have not been ready to be completed in that, but he had learned part of it. And therefore, on his own choice, listening to the, you know, if you're not ready, then these tools can become a corruption. And so the corruption was within the man, and he went off on his own saying or being thinking that it was time for the knowledge to be spread to the common person. Like right now, we're the Kabbalah today teaches that the Zohar is ready for everybody.
Right.
You don't have to feel it anymore. And why is there the change? And the explanation for the change is that we are so short on time, and because the world has become so dark, because the righteous people have left and taken the light that they revealed with them, which will be returned when they resurrect. But that whole process has made the world dark. And we need the light of the Zohar to be able to penetrate it and even to do a simple mitzvah in our generation. So these are all different approaches, different writings, different ways of perceiving our world. And since what I think is important is truth. And so truth is, I don't know, but here's what various people over the centuries have said, and there's truth in all of them. There's sparks of light in all of those teachings. What you choose to be right, that's up to you. What you choose to be your truth in this matter is up to you. And the only thing I would caution you about or suggest that you delve into is what have you absorbed from your culture, our culture, that makes you think the way you do? While Hannah didn't say it on this recording yet, when she spoke to me about this earlier tonight in the earlier class, the Mini Zohar class, she asked, because she wasn't sure she was going to be on this class, she described the question, but she was really saying that she had already made up her mind without hearing me. She just heard this student of Kabbalah express that the man from Nazareth was a Kabbalist, or was, you know, studying to be a member of the Sanhedrin, which is what they would have said if they used that language. But the whole idea is, you know, people make up their minds based on what we absorb from our culture. It's
well,
not
actually,
wrong.
It wasn't exactly, that wasn't exactly why. It was because I had read something where Zion Nefesh disagreed. And,
yes,
and I was trying to put it into perspective. Why would one say, yes, he was, and one other one would say he wasn't, and it was in the pondering that I began to think, well, maybe it's because of the Partsufim titles, and one of the titles is Son, I think it's Ben, and that's where that came from. I really hadn't.
That is correct. And I think I covered that in what I said, but not in the same language.
It's really, I've basically gotten to the point where I really didn't think the man from Nazareth really existed. From basically, you know, coming from Christianity, and I really had, I don't know, I think in this path of 25 years and seeing the, you know, the change in myself and in the readings and studying and from different points of view in that length of time, I really wondered if he really was a real person.
Well, there are people asking the same question about Moses. Again, what does your culture teach you? What did you absorb as a child?
Well, I don't look at it that way. I look at it as today. Why do I think like I do? And I think it's because I've come to see that whatever you put your faith in, you're going to experience. And that doesn't mean it's truth.
Correct. You see what you expect to see. You hear what you expect to hear. What do you expect to hear? What do you expect to see comes from what you've absorbed from your culture. And the only way you break out of that limitation that's self-created is to understand that that's what the culture is. In a very practical manner, you've heard me discuss that the suicide bomber is correct. Based on what his culture teaches, while it's a system of hate and we don't agree with it, we can't say he's wrong. We can say we have to defend ourselves, and if that means we have to kill him before he kills us, that's part of the halakha. But ultimately, that decision, that process, the suicide bomber thinks he's right. And if we truly want to love our neighbor as ourselves, which is ultimately the goal, we have to say to ourselves, if he thinks he's right, then he is right. Because if I say he's wrong, I'm becoming this coercive force. We have to learn, which is totally foreign to the current culture I was raised in and that we speak of today, the Western world. The Western world says, if I'm right, the other person must be wrong. But the Kabbalah says, you're right, that's your truth, and the other person has his own truth, and you're both right. Otherwise, why would Hashem have created the diversity of ideas and truths that we find in our world? So I have pontificated enough, and we're over time.
No, but you helped me answer the idea of a swimming pool being a mix. So, so thank you.
Was that a question?
No, it was relating to a previous conversation that Hannah and I had had over something that had happened in her life.
Donna wasn't, and she wasn't at services, so she doesn't know. but anyway, we'll talk about it at another time.
Yeah.
Okay.
Essentially, part of my role that I have loved since I was a little child, part of my role as a teacher is to challenge people. And I'm challenging people at their core values. Homosexuality is wrong. Abortion is wrong. The man from Nazareth can't be a god. I'm challenging these core values that people have absorbed from the Western world. Am I saying that you're wrong when I challenge those core values? The answer is no. I'm asking you to defend your core value and arrive at what is truth for you. Not because you absorbed it as a small child, but because it is what is true for you.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone have a beautiful evening.
Okay, thank you. This is very interesting.
Shalom.
Donnie, you have a good question.
Thank you.
Okay. Shalom.
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 Shalom. Shalom. Thank you.